Welcome to Let's Just Talk. I'm your host, Hami. It's been over 2 years since the war incident broke out, and which is now one of the most undercovered humanitarian crises in the world. Joining us to provide updates on the situation on the ground is Jahara Kanu, a non-resident fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy, who recently published a series of analysis on these events. And she's here to help us unpack what's happening and why the international community must respond now. Jahara Kanu, thank you for joining me on Let's Just Talk.
Thank you, Hami. Glad to be here today. Thank you for having me.
Of course. I'm going to get right in. Let's begin with what's happening right now in the current moment. What do you know about the scale and nature of the assaults on the Zamzam and Abu Shouk camps in Sudan?
Just to give a brief background, the Zamzam and Abu Shouk camps were established in the year 2003 during the what's known as the Darfur genocide, which took place over the course of the early years of this century, actually. And the people in these camps were people that were displaced from different villages across the region of Darfur, and they found some refuge in Al-Fashir, and ever since they've been living there. And over the years, these camps grew, actually, and they became more a bigger part of the city, which is Al-Fashir, the regional capital in Darfur, and also the capital of the North Darfur state. Over the years, these camps grew. People that were born in the camp, they still live there. Some people aged in the camp, but of course, naturally, some people also died in the camp. During this current war, we see that these camps are particularly very vulnerable to the attacks that are taking place. Al-Fashir in itself has been under siege since May 2024 by the Rapid Support Forces, which is fighting the Sudanese army and its allied forces in the city. And since this siege started taking place, all the supplies in the city were dwindling. Access to medical services was becoming less and less available. Mm-hmm. And people were struggling to even leave this siege to go to safer kind of locations. And naturally, people who have already been displaced, who have been in IDP camps, internally displaced people camps for years, are the most vulnerable. Many of them were not able to establish what we call fixed homes. In a sense, their homes were built out of local materials that are not sustainable or not durable. Many of them were also not able to get educational and job opportunities and so on. Not to mention that since the beginning of this war, because Al-Fashir was one of the safe havens in the region, all the other big capitals in the region were under the brunt of war. So many people were taking refuge in Al-Fashir and naturally in these IDP camps as well. So even the numbers, official numbers for people in these camps have increased over the course of the past 2 years to even put more pressure on the little services that were already available there. Mm-hmm. Over the past weeks, we have been witnessing continuous attacks from the Rapid Support Forces over the camps in an attempt to capture the city, and this has of course caused lots of casualties because of direct fighting, lots of casualties because of simply being hungry, and there have been reports about prevalent famine in these camps, and simply because they cannot find safe routes to exit from this fighting that's happening.
Thank you so much for breaking that down for us. We will talk about the scale of the humanitarian crisis in a second. But you mentioned Al-Fashir. Can you help us understand why Al-Fashir is so important to the RSF? And what the assault on the camps tell us about its broader strategy and what might come next?
So Al-Fashir is important for all the fighting parties, not just the RSF. For the RSF, for the Sudanese Armed Forces, and for the Joint Force. So, and I'll break it down each one. For the Rapid Support Forces, the Rapid Support Forces already controls four of the capitals of the five capitals of the Darfur region. So Darfur region is composed of five states: West Darfur, North Darfur, East Darfur, Central Darfur, and South Darfur. And the Rapid Support Forces already controls four of them, and it's only North Darfur that's remaining, and not all of North Darfur, is just its capital Al-Fashir that's remaining. Mm-hmm. So by gaining Al-Fashir, it means that the Rapid Support Forces has control over the Darfur region, which is of course historically has been a region that's been fought over for different reasons, for its resources, for its borders, and for its like geopolitical kind of weight. Of course, the region is border in Libya, it's border in Chad, it's border in the Central African Republic, and it's border in many states in Sudan. So it's a route for trade and so on. And historically, and I'll be cautious when I say this, it's considered the social incubator for the rapid support forces. And this is, of course, has different layers and can be broken down. The second thing is for the Sudanese armed forces. Of course, it's important for the Sudanese armed forces to gain territory in the region. And since this is its last one standing, it's important for them to gain this one if they are attempting to regain the ones that they lost. It's going to be more difficult to regain when you have lost everything. And for the joint forces, so the joint forces is a force that's composed of different armed groups that historically were fighting the government, but throughout the years, through different peace agreements, they're now part of the government, the de facto government in Sudan. And now they've taken the side of the army in the past year, and they're fighting alongside this army. But because these armed movements are originally from Darfur, many of them come from tribes that are native to the region, it's important for them to also make sure that they still have some kind of territory in the region and so on. And there is, of course, in Sudan, it's never simple. There's always the social factors, the tribes that, you know, these groups come from, the economic ties, the regional and border kind of relations for the different tribes and so on. So it's important for everyone to keep Al-Fashir, to be honest.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. And while we're in that line of asking about cities and why they're important, there was recently reports of the Sudanese army retaking parts of Khartoum or Khartoum itself. What does this mean for the trajectory of the war and RSF's position?
Of course, gaining the capital is a big sign. During the early days of the war, when RSF was controlling Khartoum, it was kind of astonishing for everyone. How can you gain the capital so quickly? So it gave RSF the way that they have that power and that control to gain the capital, number one, because of course it's the center of the political and economic decision, and it's a vast amount of area that's full of people that should be kind of well defended and so on. Now that it's the other way around, it's giving the Sudanese armed forces that same weight, that whoever controls the capital is basically, or people claim that it's basically controlling the country, even if it's just the capital, but it's the moral weight of it. Even though the RSF has retreated or was pushed out of the capital, and now it's the Sudanese armed forces, that doesn't mean the capital is fully
liberated.
It's fully liberated, of course. Yeah, there are still some parts that are being that are witnessing some kind of bombing, some kind of fighting. There are still some people that are accused of being parts of the militias that are being prosecuted. There is still some arms left unattended in different areas. There is still talks about dead bodies being found in people's houses on the streets. So there is still a lot of work to be done. And I think the capital is yet to be fully safe. And safe is not equal to liberated in this kind of kind of conversation.
And what does that mean for the bordering regions, right? Like if it's the capital, there's so much focus on it. But then we forget about the periphery. Could you touch on that a little bit? That what does this mean for the perception of what's happening in Sudan, and forgetting about the periphery, since now, you know, some people are so focused on the capital?
That's an interesting point, because historically in Sudan, the periphery regions have always, not always, but for the majority of our modern history, have been at war. Darfur, for example, we have Kordofan, we have the Blue Nile region, and even sometimes in eastern Sudan. So whenever it was war at the periphery or at the regions, the capital or the decision making in the center, or even the average citizen in the center, would assume that this is far away. And there wasn't so much attention being given to it. And that itself was problematic. And it has led to so many people in the country feeling that, you know, their struggles are marginalized by the center and so on. This time around, it was different, because this war started in Khartoum. Even though it had like some events here and there accumulating over the years in different parts of Sudan, but it has it was a fully fledged war in Khartoum from day one. And this has changed the kind of perception that, okay, now the war is in Khartoum, so people have all the attention on Khartoum. Since Khartoum is captured now, my personal fear is that we will go back to that square. I hope not. I hope that the struggles of the Sudanese people in different parts is still the center of attention for every Sudanese person. And I hope if any good comes out of this war is that we learn that, you know, one person's struggle is everyone's struggle in Sudan.
Amazing. Thank you so much. In your piece in Time P, right, you read about food prices soaring, humanitarian convoys being cut off, aid workers being killed. And, you know, too often it's like we hear these numbers or like this many hundreds of thousands of people are displaced. Food hasn't entered this part of the city in this many months. Could you touch on how people are feeding themselves? Because people still have to eat, or if they don't have access to that, what's happening on the ground? What's the reality like? What does daily life look like now for civilians in and around El Fasher?
I think there are two sides or two ways to look at this. When people hear all these numbers, you know, there's so much misery in the world. People just used to hearing these numbers, and it's just becoming kind of normalized. You know, you hear this amount of people is dying of hunger, this amount of people is dying of this, that. So it's kind of normalized. But in the reality of things, it's just very difficult for people to obtain the basic things. I've been following the prices, for example, for getting onion, for you to just make a stew or soup, three pieces of onion would cost you like $4. And imagine for someone who has been in a war zone for 2 years, who hasn't been working, whose only support is coming from like mobile transfers from their relatives abroad, or like from, you know, people that would just send money, or who would just use soup kitchens. That's just a big amount of money for onions. Like, how much would it cost you to get the full meal itself? So it's just a daily struggle where we see people queuing in lines for food. We see children with visible malnutrition kind of symptoms. We see mothers looking for food for their children and so on. There is that element. The other element that also people tend to overlook sometimes is the resilience of these communities. Yes, it's very difficult, but people have also found ways to deal with it. For example, since the beginning of this war, and not just in Darfur, not just in El Fasher, they've been what we call the emergency response rooms, and they've been what we call takaya, or like soup kitchens, and there've been some groups, mutual aid groups, that have been trying to work. These groups were initially supported by Sudanese diaspora and by Sudanese people abroad, and they've over the 2 years they were also receiving support from international community, international donors, and so on. And they continue to support the people by just providing a bowl of beans, for example, or something just to sustain the people throughout this period. And I want to mention that through these 2 years, these people or these groups, these mutual aid groups, have also had their ups and downs. From one end, the funding was sometimes dwindling. Sometimes people were not able to get the mobile transfers from abroad because of the connectivity issues or because of the electricity. Sometimes people were just, because also supporting for 3 years is a lot for those in the diaspora. It's becoming more difficult. And there's also the international community side. Sometimes it was difficult for these groups to access funding because the international community has its rules and regulations, its frameworks, and people are at a war zone. There is no time to fill proposals, you know, provide receipts and these kind of things. However, some actors were already trying to, like, you know, make it easier for these people, and there've been some successes there. The other element is also the fact that these people have been able to mobilize and gain the community's kind of trust. They've been targeted and persecuted by the different warring parties, because at the end of the day, the warring parties try to control whatever activity that's there. And if these people are accused of being politically affiliated with the other side, it means that the people in these front lines are also persecuted. We've been seeing stories where people have been, or it's usually young men and women, to be honest, that are being persecuted just because they're part of an emergency response room, or accused of being affiliated with the other political party because they're able to mobilize funds and get people around them and so on. Nonetheless, they've been able to sustain people for quite some time now. And I hope that this continues. For example, in El Fasher now, the mutual aid groups are pretty much what's keeping the city alive.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. And, you know, you described so vividly the scale of suffering, but also a story of resilience. And in your editorial, you are talking about the Sudanese diaspora and how involved they are. But as someone who's not Sudanese, we don't hear these stories. We don't see it in the headlines or in the media. And so I want to talk about the media coverage of the last, more than 2 years of what's happening in Sudan. What do you think explains this lack of coverage, silence, erasure, whatever you want to call it? And how is it shaping international response?
That's an interesting question, and I not necessarily have the correct answer, but I do have my kind of analysis for it. So, for example, I think, and here I don't mean that like one human suffering is more valued than the other, but they've always been this kind of ranking for the different events globally. For example, at the beginning of the Sudan war, there was the Russia-Ukraine war taking all the headlines. As we moved on, there was the Gaza war. And then there are different things. And I understand that because these different events have different kind of involvement, like in terms of actors, in terms of the countries involved, it always takes the headlines. And at the end of the day, it's all human suffering. I don't have anything against it. But I think this has caused the Sudanese kind of stories to be pushed always to the back. At the end of the day, some people mistakenly think that this is a civil war in terms of like it's an internal conflict, unlike the Russia-Ukraine war, where like different countries are involved, unlike the Gaza war, when like there is a country and then there is like all this international backing for this attack and so on. So there is the I think this is the first reason that it's always pushed because people wrongly assume that it's just an internal kind of fleeting problem of an African country that happens all the time. The second thing I think is the absence of international media in the country. And this, of course, again, the absence of the international media is historically Sudan was not always in the spotlight. So there wasn't that kind of infrastructure for international media in the country. And after the war, the international media was not able to go into the country to provide that kind of fresh coverage, and so on. So whatever that we used to see online was just video clips from average citizens trying to capture what's happening, people taking videos from their homes, local media networks trying to reflect what's happening, and then this sometimes fed into the international media. But as the war went and as the Sudanese armed forces has started gaining some territories, they've been allowing some international media to go in. But also, this is one side of the war. It's not the whole country, so it's not a full picture of everything that's happening. In general, I think also people at the end of the day, we can blame the media, but we can also blame the people for choosing not to pay attention, for just choosing to pay attention to what they want to pay attention to. Because if you it's not that difficult to find something about what's happening in Sudan.
We're putting it out right now. You're absolutely right. And yeah, and I think like we've also talked about this. I fully agree with your analysis in the sense that like African wars and African conflicts are always viewed as like these people with, who are unable to somehow govern themselves, whereas like the full picture of all of the different pieces and even the strategic importance of Sudan and or like Port Sudan, not being mentioned. It's like and also the dis the way Black bodies, especially African bodies, are disposable to the rest of the world has always been a part of our story. But nonetheless, this brings us to the involvement of other countries in the Sudan, right? Namely, you have the United Arab Emirates, you have Egypt, you have, Russia to some degree, with, Wagner Group, you have the United States to some degree, so many others. In your recent piece, you referenced the echoes of the 2003 genocide. And there's recently been a case against the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, at the ICJ, alleging that they've armed and financed the RSF. I don't know why I need alleging in front of that. But what do you make of this? Number one, the involvement of the different parties internationally. And number two, the case of genocide against the United Arab Emirates.
So yeah, as you mentioned, there are two things. The first one is the involvement of the different countries. Sudan has seven direct bordering countries, and just to put it out there, all these countries are involved one way or another because of their direct benefits, and because what I mentioned briefly at the beginning is that in these border regions, all the tribes are, you know, are on this side of the border, are on that side of the border. So it's only natural that if the part of this tribe in Sudan is being prosecuted, is being killed, that the other side would have some kind of political or armed support or whatever, depends on the situation. There is that element, the simple fact that Sudan just have many neighbors. The second one is, of course, the geopolitical kind of dynamics. You would see that some of the neighbors of Sudan are aligned with RSF because their political agenda aligns with RSF. Some of the neighbors of Sudan align with the Sudanese armed forces because their political agenda aligns with the Sudanese armed forces. Egypt, for example, is, of course, Sudan and Egypt have always have like a love-hate relationship. It's like we share a border, we share the River Nile. There've been sometimes discussions about the waters. There've been sometimes discussions about like Egypt's involvement during the colonization era and so on. But it's one of the countries that Sudan has the biggest kind of relations with. And it's only natural that Egypt would be aligned with the Sudanese state, represented by Sudanese armed forces and so on. So there is that element. During this war, there were also some reports showing the relationship between Chad and the Sudanese the Rapid Support Forces. There have also been some reports about involvement of yeah, that's at least confirmed. However, away from this neighborhood of Sudan, there've been some involvement for other countries. You've mentioned Russia through the Wagner Group. This has been involved with the Sudanese, with the Rapid Support Forces at the beginning of the war. There've been involvement of the Wagner Group supporting RSF for a while. However, there were also some involvement of Ukrainian troops that were actually seen in Omdurman fighting alongside the Sudanese armed forces. So even the global wars that are taking place elsewhere are also being fought in Sudan. And that also tells you that there is another layer of kind of not regionalization, but actually globalization of this war that's taking place. The United Arab Emirates, of course, there have been different reports since the beginning of the war about its involvement with the Rapid Support Forces, about its support to the Rapid Support Forces. And this is what led to the case at the ICJ. The case at the ICJ is basically, again, is protesting the genocide against the Masalit community, which is a community in West Darfur. And in the early month of the war, there was a massive scale kind of attack on this community. The city has all have almost been vacated of this community, where people were persecuted based on their color, based on their ethnicity, and even the language they speak. So the Masalit community were completely kicked out of their historical land and so on by the Rapid Support Forces and its allied militia. Of course, this case, I mean, if we look at it from kind of an abstract view, it's good to have a prosecution for a genocide, because at the end of the day, me personally, I wouldn't want to see any community in Sudan being subjected to this kind of horrors and so on. But we also can't handpick which genocide we persecute. We can't just pick the ones that aligns with our political kind of views. For example, we have the Darfur genocide, and the cases of the Darfur genocide have reached to the ICC before. We have people that the ICC has demanded them being delivered to it. And of course, over the years, different countries, including African countries, were not obeying that. They were actually complicit in not delivering these people. For example, the President Omar al-Bashir and other people and so on. And now, as we speak, these people are in areas that are controlled by the Sudanese armed forces, and they're not given to the ICC. So we can't choose to prosecute the genocide against Masalit because it aligns with self-standing at the moment and overlooks the other historical ones. And it wasn't even RSF at the time, but it was just allied militias involved in these accusations themselves. So we simply can't just choose. And I know there is an argument that the ICC is not, there is some criticism for the ICC, of course, that it's just, you know, persecuting African leaders. It's not necessarily the way to deliver justice and so on. But there are also local mechanisms. If SAF is able to now trial some people because they're affiliated with the RSF in absentia, why can't it prosecute
its own
people who
people.
Are accused of the genocide in Darfur 20 years ago?
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. And, you know, you mentioned African countries, and I'm just like, whoa, What if there was like a coalition of African countries and maybe like let's call it the African Union that could like, actively do something about what's going on. Crazy idea. But yeah, in on that note, this is the last question. You write about like over the last 2 years, the voices of Sudan's war victims, have been absent, only heard in the wake of massacres. Could you talk about how do we move from a reactionary place to actually elevating these voices, one, and two, if you had the ears of leaders or, the audiences of the masses in the world, what would you tell them?
Yeah, so if I may just add something to the point about African countries, because earlier I did mention something about Sudan's direct neighbors and their involvement. I didn't mention anything about the African Union. I didn't mention anything about the larger neighborhood. So for the African Union, because according to the African Union, or it's a fact actually, Sudan had a coup in 2021. So Sudan's membership at the African Union was ever since kind of frozen. So it doesn't have an active representation at the African Union level. And this was one of the reasons why the government of Sudan or SAF was somewhat lukewarm to involvements by the African Union. Because if you're like stopping our membership, then we're not necessarily fully represented and we will not be equally treated on the same grounds as the RSF, which is a militia which is a militia. Like they say you can't equate the Sudanese armed forces with the RSF and so on. So this all or most of the attempts by the African Union were not successful in bringing people at least to the negotiating table. In the larger neighborhood countries like Kenya, for example, have received a big convening for the Rapid Support Forces leadership and its kind of political allies in February this year. And this convening resulted in what they call a parallel government in areas. In areas kind of under the control of RSF. And this is, of course, very alarming because if one country is supporting the formation of a parallel government in a part of another country, then it's basically saying that they're siding with one part and they're against whatever kind of structure in that country. Of course, these people are claiming that, we want to provide services, we want to provide kind of peace and security to the people in these areas. But eventually, it is a government and it's you're basically supporting kind of dividing the country in a de facto way.
Exactly.
So this is also kind of a not so positive involvement, if I'm polite
Yeah,
about
no,
it.
like, thank you for bringing that
Coming
up.
to the point,
No, thank you
yeah.
for bringing that up. That was actually in my plan to talk about that. What Ruto has been doing and what this means actually for the future of Sudan, because once you've divided the country into small factions, then what does that mean for the reunification of the country? What does that mean for the democracy movement that took place a couple of years back, led by the masses in Sudan in order to give voices to the public? That was largely le the largest movement in the world at the time. But yeah, also like the dichotomy between South Africa, rightfully so, bringing the case of genocide for Palestinians to the ICJ and then simultaneously welcoming Hemeti or the RSF leaders in SA. But yeah, very
That
interesting.
was just, yeah, that was just mind blowing to me personally, because at the end of the day, as I said at the beginning of this episode, is that I mean, everyone's struggle should be everyone's kind of concern, because you can't just care about the struggle of one group and forget about the other, unless just assume, and it's just an assumption, it's just not even realistic that the RSF could be a legitimate representation of some group in Sudan. And South Africa was looking at it from this direction. What about the struggles and the atrocities that the RSF has been committing, which have been documented widely and available everywhere?
Right. Thank you so much. We're going to move on to the next question.
So the point you mentioned about the international community, what could be done and not just being reactionary, I think it's important to follow what's happening. For example, in 2024, It was May 2024. The UN Security Council has issued a resolution on Al-Fashir specifically, warning the RSF from its besiege of Al-Fashir, asking for international attention, asking for humanitarian support to be channeled in, and so on. And I think that was kind of a warning of what's happening now, but no one was paying attention. So I think at the end of the day, it's important to just look out there and see what are the signs of kind of looming crisis and acting upon it. There is also the element of funding. So since the beginning of this war, of course, Sudan's economy has already been struggling, and the war has wiped out most of its infrastructure. And it's important for funding to actually be available. It's we've seen how shifting the global scene of funding from the United States and from other actors have affected the humanitarian crisis in Sudan, which has already been suffering from limited funding. There have been different conferences trying to address the humanitarian crisis in Sudan, the Paris conference, and recently the conference in London, and so on. And so much money is being pledged, but not necessarily channeled down to those who need it, either because there is different layers of bureaucracy, either because there is, I mean, international bureaucracy and local bureaucracy from the Sudanese armed forces side. And of course, there is the obstacles from the rapid support forces. And finally, there is another layer of funding not being available at all, like what's happening with the US, for example, funding being shifted to different kind of avenues and so on. So I believe it's important, number one, to just pay attention to what's happening in Sudan, keeping an eye on Sudan. Then number two, to make sure that, at least this is at the international community level, to make sure that the funding that's been pledged and that's been and that's needed is actually available. In terms of individual steps, I believe it's important to, as I said earlier, to just keep an eye on the news, see what's
Stay
happening
informed.
There, amplify the voices of the local communities, follow up on what's happening, see the linkages, like, for example, which countries are involved in this war, how can we stop their involvement, how can we support this kind of, just amplification of voices of the Sudanese people in the country.
And where can people find support relief efforts as such? Or perhaps if you have like links and stuff, if you could send it to me and I could like add it to the video.
Absolutely. There are different kind of relief efforts. I mean, especially the diaspora has been having like different links and different websites for people to support. And there are different ways to also, like, I think even some of the international actors have ways of, you know, funding being support being done through like donations and these kind of things. So I'll definitely share some links with you to be put in the description for those who are interested, and also some links for like different avenues for people to look for news and so on.
Amazing. Kanu, thank you so much for your time and continued work bringing these truths forward. And we look forward to continuing these conversations with you in the future.
Thank you so much, Han.